In Dark Harbor, the wharf of the New York waterfront, Nathan Ward reminds us that New York City's docks were very different in the 40s and 50s. As the New York Sun's Malcolm Mike Johnson reported at the time, they functioned as a world unto themselves, a mix of corrupt labor leaders, mobsters, and immigrants just trying to earn a day's pay. Mr. Johnson's series of articles that expose life on the city's docks were the inspiration for Ilya Kazan's film On the Waterfront. The book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it brings Nathan Ward to our studios today. Hello. With all of the development that's taken place in the last 15 to 20 years, it's hard to remember that the New York waterfront was anything other than a hip playground. But you remind us that it was once said to produce more murders per square foot than any other part of the country. Really?
That was what the Manhattan DA said in the late 40s. It certainly produced more unsolved murders than any other place in the country because of the lack of witnesses, willing witnesses.
Should we just talk about the waterfront, or was it a difference between the Hudson River, the East River, and the Brooklyn docks?
Well, the book struggles to keep going around the whole harbor, so I guess we should do it that way.
In the end, they all wound up receiving the same sorts of things, right? And New York once had one of the most thriving waterfronts.
The most thriving, yeah. It was. I mean, that's the thing. You had incredible commerce, and the pilferage was there was a large temptation because it was so thriving, especially in the mid part of the century. The gangs that really came with Prohibition then settled in, and Joe Ryan, who was the leader of the Longshore Union from 1928 to the early 50s, had made the mistake of inviting in a lot of the racketeers, and it's hard to get rid of them once they're in a situation like that.
What do you mean he made the mistake? You don't make that kind of mistake.
Well, if you need strength for the fight, and you get
he saw them as a way of
tough guys in.
Oh, I see.
You can look at him as either a king or a captive. You know, he ran the union, but he had it would have been hard to get rid of a lot of these guys after a time.
So he brought them in as enforcers and wound up being their victims.
When the union was establishing itself versus other ones like the Five Points leader Paul Vaccarelli in the teens. Then after there was one union after that, and that was a setup. It was his own city. It functioned as its own city, and people didn't think very much about it unless they were getting on a cruise ship or meeting someone down there, or they needed a casual job.
And the mob sought a certain amount of respectability. I remember the Anthony Anastasia Medical Clinic.
Yep.
In Carroll Gardens on Court Street. It's now
right.
A vacant lot. But, the first time I saw it, I was like, wait, Tough Tony Anastasia?
Tough Tony. He did do some important things, especially in the late 50s, early 60s. He was significantly related to his brother, which gave him, his words, a power. But he did do a lot of things in the later years in Brooklyn. Most notably that.
What was a typical morning like at the docks?
Well, if we're talking about the period that people think they know from movies, where you start with the shape up,
mm-hmm.
that I got interested in this because. I thought all those movies were hyperbole. I thought it was just over-the-top Hollywood stuff. But most of the films, especially in the early 50s, were just using testimony from the crime commission hearings of 52, 53, especially On the Waterfront, which a lot of your favorite lines come right out of the witness testimony that in Bud Schulberg sat there for 40 days writing down what he heard as doc witness after doc witness told what it was really like.
And the kickbacks came on in all different directions. The importers had to – the ships had to pay kickbacks, the mm-hmm. importers, but also the people who were seeking jobs, and they were poor.
That's right. They were poor and desperate, and at least at that time – the leadership under Joe Ryan liked it that way. He resisted their attempt to get back pay, which infuriated the shippers, and he settled contracts that they would then walk out on in 1948, 51, and 45. There was a real dichotomy between the leadership and the guys on the docks.
Well, why didn't they just get rid of them? Weren't there elections?
There were elections of a kind, yes.
I guess they were as rigged as some elections we've seen in certain countries, even in the United States. What was it that prompted the New York Sun's investigative reports on life on the docks?
Well, it began with one murder of a hiring foreman named Thomas Collentine, who worked on Pier 92. Pier 92 is one of the ones that's actually still there. You can go look at it now. It hasn't been turned into a stroller paradise.
It's still a working dock?
It's in the luxury liner row, what they used to call luxury liner row. It's about 51st Street.
But most of the luxury liners these days are going to Red Hook, aren't they?
That's right.
And which would have been unheard of
yes,
in the past.
Right. Well, that has also to do with how deep water they need. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Mike Johnson was given this report by his boss, Ed Bartnett, because the murder reminded him of one from the year before, and he thought perhaps there was a link between these dock war incidents, and he should go check it out. He spent 6 months starting with that murder, and produced his 24-part series, which won the Pulitzer Prize.
Well, today that would be a 3-to-5-part series.
It would. What originally caught my eye was a 24-part series on mobsters in 1948 on the front page every day. I just couldn't get over that. I had to know more about it.
I would have been afraid for my life writing those reports.
His wife got all these calls. Knock it off, or we're gonna kill you. The children, Haynes Johnson, his son, reports that they were assured by their dad that they'd never kill a reporter, and you know he doesn't think his father entirely believed that, and he then had his an unlisted number the rest of his life. But that's what they were told.
Well, Haynes Johnson has done rather well as a reporter, as a journalist, too.
He has. They're the only father-son Pulitzer winners.
Mike Johnson also reported on the Ku Klux Klan, so he liked to take on these dangerous assignments.
He had his father was a lawyer in Georgia, and he had done some work against the Klan himself, and I think that was something that came directly out of his father's influence, and it was good training for later being threatened by mobsters up north.
My guest is Nathan Ward, who's written a book called Dark Harbor, The War for the New York Waterfront. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. The murder you were talking about was of a man named Thomas Collentino. Collentine?
I pronounce it that way. I have not.
Could be Collentine, I guess.
Could have been Collentine.
And what
that
made
more
this
refined, I guess.
What made it any different from all the other murders on the docks?
Well, that's the thing. When he looked into it, you would have all these, 2-inch-long stories of longshoremen slain, and then you get to the bottom of the story, and it would turn out that the victim had been acquitted the year before in another longshoreman slaying, acquitted because there were no witnesses that wanted to talk about it. And one after another, it was their own system of justice, it seems, sort of. And I developed something I called the payback file, where I would keep all these old murder stories that's you could string them together. And that's what he did. He got to the, he saw the rackets behind all this and the graft at stake. In who controlled which pier, and if their hiring boss was not cooperative, he was replaced either legally or illegally.
Now, the Longshoremen's Union on the West Coast was called a communist union. Mm-hmm. Joe Ryan used that, didn't he? There was even a Cold War aspect to the fight for power.
There certainly was. I mean, he was a big red baiter. If you disagreed with him, that's the
he called
category.
You a communist.
Yeah, and it was very effective. I mean, the West Coast story, they did clean it up. They did have an entirely different experience out west, and that was originally one union. And it's the break came when, in 1934, there was a big strike in San Francisco, and Joe Ryan went out to tell them to settle, and they said, "The hell with you!" And that was the division.
What was the relationship between Joe Ryan and the mayor of New York at the time, William O'Dwyer?
Well, I mean, Joe Ryan had very strong ties to Tammany. O'Dwyer had a lot of friends in many places around New York. I mean, he knew Frank Costello, and he had been he was a failed seminarian who then became a cop, who then became a lawyer, and then became a prosecutor, and then became briefly a brigadier general, and then became mayor. So he's not just a Tammany figure. He would give a speech to Tammany that was an anti-corruption speech. I mean, that's what he would do. He could work both sides like that.
But meanwhile, remain friends with Joe Ryan. How long sure. did Joe Ryan remain in power? He was president for life. Did he die in office?
No, he finally had to leave in I think it's 1953 when the Crime Commission report they found that of all the irony is he was. A lot of the money that was going to this sort of anti-communist fund, as they called it, in the union, was going to his trips to Guatemala, his shirts, his car repairs, and that's where he tripped up.
Well, was the union ever cleaned up, or did the docks just kind of die and that changed everything?
Well, there are inspiring groups within the ILA today. It's not really for me to say how exactly what the conditions are now. I do know there's still problems, although it's miniaturized, obviously, from the old days. But, some of the mobsters then went into container repair as opposed to what they used to do.
What about Father John Carradine? Mm-hmm. Was he the inspiration for the Carl Malden character in On the Waterfront?
He was. And he also loaned his hat and coat to Carl Malden to make the transformation complete.
And what was his role on the docks?
Well, he was a reformer who kept tabs on everything that untoward that happened. And he had these great file cabinets. He had 14 file cabinets in his basement office of the labor school that I wish I could have had access to when they were still, before they'd been donated to Fordham and recategorized, when he had everything under racketeers or, all the, he had every murder or pilferage that had ever happened in this wonderful filing cabinet system.
Did the FBI ever get involved in investigating what was going on the waterfront? After all, this would have been within its purview.
They did, but as dramatized in the film, it's very hard to make a case when people won't testify. You don't have to have widespread corruption in the police department to have a dearth of prosecutions.
What about Mike Johnson's series? Did it have much of an impact?
It did. But his prime source was a guy named Bill Keating, who was an assistant DA under Frank Hogan, and he had prosecuted the one successful waterfront murder case in 20 years, which against Cockeye Dunn and Andrew Sheridan and a guy named Gentile, and then thought there would be a new era of fearless prosecutions of the waterfront gangsters. And when that didn't happen, he decided to light a fire under his boss by leaking this story to Mike Johnson. He let him come in and see what they had on all, who controlled which docks. And that's really how it started.
And was there a difference? Joe Ryan was the boss of the whole thing, but mm-hmm. you suggested earlier Brooklyn was not the same as Manhattan.
Well, a lot of these were broken up by ethnic rivalry, and you had the Irish on the west side, ostensibly in control of the Union, and then the Italians on the Brooklyn side, what they called the Camarda or Italian locals, and you know they were under him, but I think he was sometimes puzzled by the over there in Brooklyn.
Well, those areas are now being gentrified. Red Hook and Cobble Hill and Carroll Gardens.
I had a hard time keeping those names out of the book, actually. You know,
because they weren't called that then.
Right, then it gets confusing.
Just one more thing, and we have very little time. Francine from Brooklyn asks if it's true that in World War II, the U.S. government made deals with the mob to monitor the waterfront.
They certainly did consult them as experts on the waterfront for signs of sabotage. My favorite image is of Sox Lanza, who was really in charge of the seaport in those days, interviewing Maine lobstermen in a boat for if they'd heard anything.
Nathan Ward will be in conversation with James Mara tonight at 6:30 at Mysterious Bookstore at 58 Warren Street. His book, Dark Harbor, The War for the New York Waterfront, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yep, my pleasure.